House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. It's February 3rd. We have our first hearing of bills today. But before that, we're happy to have Chris Maples, President of Oregon Institute of Technology, here to help us kick off a bit of a discussion about what's going on in the higher education world as it regards sustainability. We're going to continue this conversation in a subsequent meeting when we'll hear from some of the other campuses around the state, but we really appreciate Mr. Maples making the journey, and we're also fortunate to have Representative Garrard here to help introduce him. So if you gentlemen wouldn't mind coming forward, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Bill Garrard from District 56, which is southern Klamath County. I'm pleased to introduce to you today one of the great economic forces in the southern part of the state, Chris Maples, the president of Oregon Institute of Technology. If you have the opportunity to spend 5 minutes with this man, he will make you a fan of OIT and a supporter. So watch out. I'll give you that warning. OIT is the jewel in the crown in the Klamath Basin. Due to the tragic death of former President Martha Ann Dow, President Maples took the reins at OIT in October of 2008. One of the amazing things about our school in Klamath is the fact that it has a 98% placement rate, even in these difficult economic times. It says a lot about the quality of education. It should be noted that President Maples is currently appointed to the Department of Defense and has a top secret clearance. He also has a Q-level security clearance from the Department of Energy. I have to ask him afterwards what a Q-level security is. He's also a well-published professional. I could go on primarily for a couple of hours in introducing him to you, but I'll simply say this. His resume is 22 pages long. Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, members of the committee, may I introduce somebody that Klamath Falls has already fallen in love with, President Chris Maples of OIT.
Thank you, Representative Garrard. Thanks for being here, and thanks for noting his long resume. Perhaps we'll work on some ways to present that to the committee in a sustainable way.
Our basketball team is still in the top 10 in the nation and are defending national champions. So,
fantastic.
You can quit kicking me now.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Representative.
You're welcome. I have never had a better introduction. Thank you. I appreciate that. Chairman Reed, Vice Chair Vince, Vice Chair Galicia, Representative Bailey, Representative Gilliam, Representative Thatcher, and Representative Witt, and Representative Hovey. My name is Chris Maples, President of Oregon Institute of Technology. I really want to thank you all very much for this opportunity to share a little bit about OIT and about our sustainability and economic development aspects that we are doing. I'm actually new to Oregon, as noted earlier. I started October 1st at OIT. I moved here from Nevada. And I've been actually on a fact-finding tour, as it were, of OIT's 8 campuses that we have. 7 in Oregon, 1 in Seattle, Washington. So I've been touring our campuses. I've talked with our students. I've talked with our faculty. I've talked with our alumni. It's very important to me to understand a lot about OIT's background, history, culture, the things that we do well, and to build on those things that we do well. Former President Martha Ann Dow did a remarkable job in heading the institution in the right direction in several respects, and in being able to see almost visionary-like down the line for things that were going to be relevant and important and useful for years to come. And it is my goal to build on her legacy and to go with the rest of Klamath Basin and Oregon and the Pacific Northwest to take OIT to better and better places. You have a handout that includes written testimony, and it also includes essentially a PowerPoint slide presentation that I'm not doing as a PowerPoint slide presentation. I prefer to be a little bit more conversational, and I've learned in lectures over the years that PowerPoints tend to stifle questions. Often people just sort of get glazed over as the PowerPoints are clicking along. I will tell you that pages 1, 2, and 3 are what are covered here in this next chunk that I will talk a little bit about. I want to give you an overview of OIT and a little bit about service throughout the state. We provide technology-based educational opportunities at the undergraduate level, as noted at the 7 locations within Oregon and in Seattle, Washington, where we partner with the Boeing Company. Our main campus is in Klamath Falls, where the Institute was founded in 1947. And much of that origin was to provide a place for returning veterans from World War II. And as a veteran myself, I'm actually very proud of that history of OIT and the way that the Klamath Basin in general views veterans and welcomes veterans. In 1983, we began delivering upper division coursework in the Portland metropolitan area, and we now have 4 locations in Portland and the adjacent communities. We have a respiratory care program in Medford that we operate in cooperation with Rowe Community College. We have a dental hygiene program in LeGrand in partnership with ODS and Eastern Oregon University. And currently our sole graduate program is Manufacturing Engineering Technology, and that is offered in Klamath Falls, Portland, and in Seattle at the Boeing campus. Our programs with Boeing in Seattle and our dental hygiene program in LeGrand with ODS and Eastern Oregon are really excellent examples, in my estimation, of the collaboration and the private-public partnerships that we value at OIT. The Seattle story has been an interesting one for me to learn when I went to visit the programs there. Boeing asked around within the state of Washington to have engineering, accredited engineering, delivered to many of their employees because Boeing values accredited engineers working for them. And in fact, once the employees get an accredited engineering degree, it makes an instantaneous $30,000 a year difference in their salary just by having that accredited degree. The Washington schools were fairly large, fairly non-mobile, and they basically all said, we deliver what we deliver on our campuses, and that's pretty much it. Somebody had heard of OIT or had graduated from OIT, recommended OIT to them. They came to us, and we said, sure, we will deliver on your site, and we will tailor a program to suit you, and this is how we'll work this public-private partnership. And it's been great. It has gone from a few students to over 120 now, just with that program. And again, an excellent relationship. OIT is known for its readily employable graduates. Each program has an industry advisory council, and that council works to ensure that the curricula are immediately relevant, up to date, that our faculty understand the importance and have the ability to stay up to date with changes in the industry itself. We don't do as much research as a lot of the research institutions. We work very closely with industry, with the private sector, where a lot of that groundbreaking research goes on. We work closely with them to put those groundbreaking results into practice. The applied hands-on nature of what we do at OIT is a critical component of our success. And it's one of the main reasons a lot of our students enroll at OIT to begin with. In a survey of 2006 graduates, 98%, as noted earlier, were either employed or in graduate school 6 months after graduation. I did a quick survey of what the graduate schools were that our students had gone to in that period of time. University of Oregon, Oregon State, Portland State, University of Washington, Nevada, Arizona State, BYU. It's a reasonably good list, and it's primarily Western states. It's a crowd that is staying fairly locally as much as they can after graduation. OIT has an enrollment of about 3,300 students. That's for all of our locations combined. And I would tell you that one of the hallmarks of OIT experience is the personal approach to education. Our student-to-faculty ratio is 15 to 1, and every student must complete an applied project. In many cases, that is a research-based project that they have to complete before they graduate. Our faculty members know their students, and our students are able to focus their interest on meaningful learning experiences. And so last week, as part of all this understanding where we were and what OIT was, we unveiled a tagline, Hands-on Education for Real-World Achievement. A quick sidebar. My background is very research-intensive. I've done a fair amount of research over the years in the geological sciences. I've been at Research One institutions. I worked at the National Science Foundation as a program director. I got my start at a very small four-year institution in rural Georgia. And I did so because that was the size of school that I wanted to start with. And it prepared me by having that hands-on experience that I could not have gotten at a larger institution. I was able to go out in the field. I worked with professors. I knew them. I actually did the job of being a geologist so that when I went to a graduate program and I went to the first graduate class and we went out to the field to actually do work, I was the only one in the class that actually knew how to do the work of the class because I had done it. And it was that component that really sold me on OIT just to begin with. It was one of the things that made OIT special. The Institute's work in the sustainable realm really began in 1963, probably long before sustainability became a buzzword. When a student senior project involved documenting geothermal wells in use throughout Klamath Falls. The following year, the Klamath Falls campus moved to its current site where geothermal technology was utilized to heat and cool many of the campus buildings. In 1974, there was a geothermal conference that was held at the Klamath Falls campus, and a national clearinghouse of information on geothermal technology was founded there as the GeoHeat Center. The GeoHeat Center has gone on to receive international recognition for its consulting work in the field. Consequently, our engineering students have had this vital learning resource available to them for more than 30 years. In fact, the current director of the GeoHeat Center, Dr. John Lund, is an emeritus professor from civil engineering, and the assistant director, Ms. Toni Boyd, is an OIT alumna from that program as well. Now, at this point, pages 3, 4, and 5 of that PowerPoint handout be relevant. We go to those pages. The GeoHeat Center is now part of what's called the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, or OREC, which was cited at OIT by the Oregon Legislature in 2001. And it's in part because of the work being done at OIT in geothermal, solar, and hybrid car technologies by our students and faculty. Earlier this decade, a cross-disciplinary group from OIT's Computer Systems Engineering Technology, Mechanical Engineering, and Electronics Engineering departments created a home climate monitoring system that cost about 1/100th of the price of a commercial unit. And I've been told that those prices were about $300 as compared to about $30,000. That technology was then used in Portland's Rose House and in the Cannon Beach Cottage. The Cannon Beach Cottage received national attention for the use of sustainable practices throughout its construction, and that included the OIT-created home climate monitoring system. In the spring of 2005, OIT became the first university in the nation to offer a renewable energy systems bachelor's degree. And we have gone from 4 students enrolled in that program to 118 at this point. And as I was sitting on the campus at Harmony Road in Portland this morning, there were 3 students who came in requesting additional information about the renewable energy now engineering degree that we are offering, the first in the country. Others are going to be coming down the line. Other institutions will be trying to copy this, I guarantee you, because it's relevant and it's really, really useful. There is a rigor to how we go at these degrees that I'm particularly proud of. Our students work hard. It's almost legendary. how much time and effort they put into getting these degrees. They're focused. They get the basics. They understand all these basics, which is why they're able to be successful, not just in the hands-on application of this work, but in graduate schools if they decide they want to go to a graduate program. Sustainability is really a theme across the OIT campuses, and it is implemented throughout the curriculum in the School of Engineering Management Technology. A few examples of the things that we are doing. Our civil engineering students are involved with green building techniques and transportation systems. Our computer systems engineering technology majors help with the control systems for biofuels production and the previously noted building control systems. We have electronics engineering students who study power electronics, while their peers in geomatics, which is a land surveying, is what it was formerly known as. Their peers in geomatics prepare sites for analyses for wind and solar farms and have the option of specializing in geographic information systems. The management department currently is under review to offer a management entrepreneurship degree in renewable energy, and operations management students learn about lean management practices, especially in the areas of production and manufacturing. And our health informatics option within information technology addresses the current move toward a paperless healthcare system with all the cost savings and minimizing of redundancies that goes with that ability to transfer information back and forth and do so very efficiently. Our Department of Manufacturing and Mechanical Engineering and Technology has students involved with wind, solar, geothermal, and wave energy, as well as lean manufacturing systems there. Page 6 of that PowerPoint handout has a couple of more slides. On January 24th, we broke ground for a deep geothermal well that we anticipate will produce water at a temperature of above 300 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the water that will power a steam turbine that will create electricity to serve the entire need of the Klamath Falls campus. Right now, we are anticipating and hoping to put in a 3 megawatt power generating plant. The campus itself uses about 1.5 megawatts. That leaves us another 1.5 megawatts to put back onto the grid to help supply with the hospital across the street. And we really will hopefully be able to attract some small green industry to a green development park around the edge of OIT with some of the land that's there. We think having that power, that green power, will attract potentially a number of small industries that might come into that area. We were really happy with the groundbreaking ceremony that we hosted, and we had engineers even from Iceland there who were there learning about our techniques and how they were going to apply some of our drilling and techniques to their geothermal resources as well. When all this occurs, OIT will be the first university in the world to be powered entirely by geothermal technology. Just as we were the first in the nation to be heated and cooled entirely by geothermal processes and the first to offer a renewable energy engineering degree. We are working with the Oregon University System to create this green energy demonstration park, and that excess power, we are pretty convinced, will be able to attract additional businesses, and this is a real economic development opportunity. In keeping with OIT's public-private connections, one of our renewable energy engineering faculty members, Dr. Mateo Avoy, who works up here in the Portland area, recently has passed the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office bar examination. I didn't realize they had a separate bar examination for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, but he passed it. And he's an engineer by trade. He did this on his own. So this accomplishment by one of our premier engineering faculty members will really enable OIT to be able to serve the needs of our students who want to learn more about the basics of not only protecting their intellectual property, but of moving a lot of that intellectual property into the marketplace and doing so in a really expeditious way. Indeed, our faculty members and administrative leaders are all in continual conversation with business representatives to strengthen opportunities for our students and for Oregon citizens as a whole. Finally, I should note that OIT has a very active and very creative sustainability committee with a number of students, staff, faculty members, just everybody connected with OIT is involved with this sustainability committee, and this committee makes recommendations for green sustainable practices throughout the university. Coupled with our industry-based renewable energy engineering advisory board, these two constituent-based groups will keep the OIT efforts in sustainability and economic development fresh and relevant. I hope this gives you a feeling for some of OIT's unique niche across the state of Oregon and in the Pacific Northwest. As noted earlier, our philosophical approach to education, small classes, rigorous programs, dedicated faculty, applied fields of study is embodied in our new tagline, hands-on education for real-world achievement. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to say a few words about this, to let you know a bit about OIT, a bit about our sustainability and economic development aspects. Honestly, I've hit the tip of the iceberg. It is the hallmark of what we have done over the years. And that has really served the people of Oregon well. As a new person being able to walk in from the outside, I've seen in a very short period of time a remarkable impact on the state from a fairly small institution with a very broad reach. I thank you all very much, and I'll address questions to the best of my ability, being that I'm new. And if I can't answer them here, I will get back to you with the answers. So thank you all.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Representative Greyer, I appreciate you sticking around. It occurred to me as the President was speaking, I didn't probably appropriately give you the opportunity to depart. You have a busy schedule as well, so please feel free to take that opportunity. We won't be offended because we know how busy you can be.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Your courtesy to me to be here with President Maples is very much appreciated.
Glad you could do it. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, President Maples.
Thank you, sir.
And I was glad for that clarification. I came in just a bit late, and I didn't realize who was with you. I thought it was your athletic director.
I think he's the PA.
Could have used basketball coach.
Really,
are you a broadcaster? Maybe
I just have one quick question.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if have you had a chance to be on campus at my alma mater, Water Pacific in Portland.
I have. I attended the game where we got beat a couple of weeks.
That's really what I wanted on record.
I understand. Thank you very much. I understand that.
But you're welcome at this committee nonetheless.
I believe there's a game this Friday.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Down in Klamath Falls. Please, you're welcome to join us if you would like to
do that.
So. We're tied for first, as it stands right now, as I recall, with Eastern.
But congratulations
and you guys.
To you. You
and
had
you
a
guys.
Great
okay. Representative Holby, I suspect you perhaps have a different line of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a different line of questioning.
Although the basketball game with your alma mater might be a little bit interesting, too.
Maybe last year it was interesting, not this year.
Which is?
The University of Oregon.
I feel your pain. Mine's Indiana University.
But I did have a question. I'm really curious about the geothermal applications that you have down there at Klamath Falls, and I've sort of looked at it a little bit and really intrigued by it. I'm wondering whether in your research, whether your institution has looked at the viability of geothermal in different places around the state, or whether you're just sort of focused on Klamath Falls, because I know there's other exploration around the state as far as geothermal and its uses, particularly in generating energy, electricity, as opposed to just heating.
Right. The use of geothermal for kilowatts as opposed to BTUs does require a much hotter source or some way of heating the source itself. I know there's been drilling recently in the Newberry Crater area where a pretty deep, unfortunately dry hole was found. The temperature's there, the water's not. And that's always a bit of a dice roll when you're trying to look deeply into the earth with various techniques, seismology, the geology that you know, etc. Deep sources for electricity tend to be localized and regional. shallow sources for heat pump and cool heat pump in the wintertime, cooling in the summer, are completely across the board anywhere in the country. And that would offset an enormous amount of power just that if you didn't even have the deep resource. And there's more and more effort to look at that. One of the things that the Geo Heat Center does is field a lot of questions of a technical nature of that type from everywhere across the country and occasionally internationally.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So has there been a geographic study just mapping out the potential areas in the state of Oregon for those resources?
I couldn't put my hands on it right now. I know that the U.S. Geological Survey has done a fair amount of that in different places in the country, as has the Department of Energy through some of their funding of additional geological studies. I don't know what specifically has been done in Oregon in that regard. It's the same type of mapping of resource that you see now with wind resource mapping, with solar resource mapping, and you look for these locations where you can site some of these energy generating units. The wind resource mapping is also a very interesting aspect, because with additional engineering developments, some of the marginal wind places that many people would think would be plenty windy enough are actually coming into play. Much like additional engineering developments allow deeper and deeper drilling of oil or deeper offshore drilling for oil, same thing is happening in the renewable energy side with engineering developments, not only in wind energy, but some of the solar.
Representative Holby's question prompted one from me, follow up on that. How do you coordinate with the other institutions of higher education to do some of that basic research? It sounds like some of those surveys and inventory kinds of work are things that you do, and just to make sure that we're not, maybe there's a time where two surveys is worthwhile, but so that they're coordinated. How do you do that?
We utilize a lot of material, and we try to make the information that we have and use applicable and move the information to a real world type of application, and this is really different from a more theoretical basic research, expand the horizons and push the envelope type of approach. They are very complementary. The one leads to the other. And so there's no overlap, there's no really redundancy, there's really, as much as anything else, there's a handoff of sorts, where some of that basic information is then used by industry and businesses, but used by some of our faculty and students, and applied in a different way.
That's a helpful image. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was happy to hear you say you're tied with Eastern, my alma mater, so I can only hope that,
I was there this past weekend where we lost as well. Thank you, sir.
Sorry to hear that.
I can tell.
The question I have is this. My law firm is involved in a number of geothermal projects across Eastern Oregon, and one of the common issues to all of these projects that find themselves located in the middle of nowhere is, one, how to make sure the project is appropriate when it comes to, let's say, public land issues, and the second, how to move the power out.
Correct.
And again, encountering difficult transmission issues. So my question to you is, does your program have a part of it which trains people in how to address those types of issues to facilitate working with public entities like the BLM and the Forest Service, and then all of the groups that are concerned about environmental damage that these types of things do?
We have an environmental sciences program on campus, and it feeds in many respects. There's a lot of overlap with a number of the engineering programs that we offer, including those in the renewable energy engineering. In terms of the distribution network, the transmission lines that are needed, that's primarily handled on the private sector side. We have people who can help with understanding how to move electricity out of these generating power plants onto such a grid, but we don't have people actually working on grid development per se. And it looks more and more like that grid development is going to be a real challenge for moving lots of power this way, and that what will happen is there's going to be a lot more of a distributed network. And so what we have people doing is looking at these renewable energy systems, as it were, where you'll have geothermal some, you may use solar a little bit, you may use a little bit of wind, and you combine these different things with some battery storage life to be able to use a combined portfolio in a smaller scale package of different types of sustainable energy, renewable energy generating features, and really do a lot of energy that way.
Follow up, please. I guess we had a presentation, I think last week now, but from a gentleman who from an agency whose organization whose job it is to try to streamline certain business practices, mm-hmm. and one of the things that some of the folks testified to was the difficulty they had when it came to government and other types of regulatory involvement. So it seems to me that there's an opportunity for a large group of people to try to figure out how to make more efficient mm-hmm. that intersection between business, technology on the one hand, and all of us on the other called government. And that's what I'm asking. I'm wondering if your organization, okay. if your school is training people in how to wander around in that most difficult area and try to make more efficient that interaction.
To my knowledge, we're not. I can double check and make sure that that's the case. And I agree with you. I think there's a real opportunity there to try to streamline that process and make that process more transparent so that people are better able to bring those resources online. It's whatever federal agency happens to have the land that will be the challenge, whether it's BLM or Forest Service or whomever, and working within that federal system. I would tell you that a step in that direction is Mateo Aboy's passing of that bar exam for patent law. That is actually helpful in getting people through at least one part of that set of issues of getting these technologies available.
I appreciate that connection to the interdisciplinary stuff. When I was in business school, I took some classes at the public affairs school, and I was always a very strange person in the public affairs school from the business school and the reverse. It's good to have that cross path. Yeah. Representative Bailey, you had your hand up, and then I'll come to you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Maples, I recall a presentation from one of your colleagues talking a little bit about some of the various models and research that you're using in geothermal research. I'm curious if you could talk just a little bit more about the national and international collaboration that your university is doing in developing some of these technologies.
Sure. We have some support and collaboration with Department of Energy, who's helping to fund some of our work, and we have international collaboration. Again, we had people from Iceland here observing our institution, and we've visited there to learn some of their techniques. Several countries are doing a number of things in geothermal, including New Zealand and Japan. And again, we're doing some exchange back and forth to talk with them. In addition to exchanging just information and ideas, we're working on trying to get some students potentially back and forth, and potentially even some faculty visits as we move forward. John Lund, who is internationally known for the work that he has done, was recently in Germany to receive a fairly substantial international award for the work that he has done as recognized by the German government.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Maples, President Maples, I was looking at some of your slides here. I'm just curious, is your geothermal well, is that a closed cycle system?
It will be.
It will be. Okay. Very interesting. And the ethanol still, what is your what's your feedstock there?
It had been algae, and I'm not sure if they're still headed that way or not with some of the algal. But there's a lot of algae in that lake.
Amazing.
And it's interesting. There's been a fair amount of work on ethanol production from algae. There are certain algae that are high in lipids mm-hmm. that are particularly good for that. It turns out they're sort of odd algae. They have to live in certain types of conditions. They sort of, you know, they don't do well out in the wild. They get
beat out by all the other wild algae.
I see. That's very good, cutting edge.
Well, it's the cutting edge application. It's interesting. In the years that I've dealt with research, I've become acutely aware of this chasm, and it's a chasm between laboratory demonstration and scaling up to real-world applicability and marketability, and trying to help bridge that gap, that chasm, is one of the things that I think OIT has done in the past well and has a great future in moving forward.
Well, it's not only intriguing. I suspect it's very fun and very necessary.
It's really cool. And you find out a lot of things. I mean, the students get really involved in these things just as sidebars, and they learn a lot about the types of energy that they're working with. We have students now working on a senior project in which they are building an electric drag racer. entirely an electric drag racer, which I didn't realize there was so much power that gets transmitted so rapidly to the wheels. Mm-hmm. The challenge that they're having in an electric drag racer is having the computer system engaged in place to make the millisecond changes in the amount of torque so that they don't lose traction and they don't sit there and spin the wheels.
Thank you. Perhaps an example of that chasm. And I think to a certain extent you have maybe answered the question I was going to ask, but I wanted to sort of see, how do you balance, it seems like there are at least a couple of directions a university might go in terms of responding to the needs and interests of industry or going truly cutting edge. How do you balance those two? And feel free, if you feel like you answered that in the last question, feel free to say that, refer back to that.
No, I think that's actually a fundamental question that gets to the heart of what a lot of institutions of higher education grapple with in many respects. We have worked with some high-tech industry over the years. Intel, Microsoft, International Gaming Technology, just a few. And what we have done is, by working closely with them, they are putting a lot of money and effort and research into their own cutting-edge techniques. The key for us is making sure that our faculty get up to date and stay up to date and have time to understand these advances that are happening in industry and are able to bring those back to classrooms. Because our students all do projects that often are research-based, and many of them do internships and externships with industry, or even are on the applied, the health allied health sciences side. They do externships with some of the finest hospitals in the country, learning new techniques, new instrumentation. Because of all this, it's equally important for our faculty to have time to do that as well. Because often our students get sometimes a little bit better of an insight and a little bit earlier peak than some of our faculty do. And then that learning takes a flip of sorts.
Any other questions? Well, I really am glad that you had the time to come help us get oriented. We're taking a sort of a metaphorical trip around what's going on in the state, and you've added a lot to our understanding, so appreciate you making the trip.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity, and you all have a standing invitation anytime to visit any one of our campuses.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Representative Greer.
Thank you.
We will transition a little bit here and get going on some hearings. We have four bills up for public hearing, all from the Housing and Community Services Department. And we will start right in, unless anyone has any opening comments, and open a hearing on House Bill 2256. We have Rick Krager here from the department, who can help us get oriented to the bill, unless you want to offer Barbara any summary or...
I certainly can. Just very briefly, House Bill 2256 requires the Oregon Housing and Community Services to establish a minimum threshold amount above which proposed housing grants or other housing funding proposals require review by the Oregon Housing Council. Authorizes OHCS to set future minimum thresholds by administrative rule with council approval.
Good. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Crager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Thank you for having me here today, and look forward to talking to you about each of these bills. Starting today with House Bill 2256, and I would like to provide you some written testimony specific to that. So as that's coming around, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2256 essentially is a request to allow the State Housing Council to adopt guidelines for loan and grant threshold approval for all applicable housing programs. Let me first provide you with a little bit of background. Oregon Housing Community Services has a State Housing Council that administers and provides oversight and loan approvals for all of our housing programs. In law, currently, there is specifics in terms of the thresholds in which those loans are approved. As a little bit more background, in 2005, the Oregon Housing Community Services approached the legislature and requested that the Housing Council be given the authority to establish its thresholds by administrative rule, and that the law be changed for the single-family loan program. At that time, there was a exact amount that was in law, and what it was changed to was give the Housing Council the authority to change that via administrative rule as the housing market changed, because what was 5 years ago is different than what is now, and so they wanted to be able to have that flexibility to change the loan thresholds as market conditions changed. So we were successful in implementing that particular law. We did establish administrative rules. They were able to create a threshold for the single family loan program. And what we're here before you today is in House Bill 2256 is now to give the authority for the Housing Council to have the ability to set that same loan threshold for all of its housing programs, including the multifamily. There are two separate sections of the law, one that speaks specifically to the single family, which we changed in 2005, and then there's another piece that speaks specifically to all the other housing programs. So we are essentially asking for that to be changed. Primarily, Mr. Chairman, what this would do is create a lot more flexibility for the State Housing Council. Again, as business needs change, as market conditions change, they would have the flexibility in the programs to make those adjustments. So with that, Mr. Chairman, there is no fiscal impact to this bill, and we would request that you move House Bill 2256 forward, and I'm available for any questions you have on that.
Thank you. Just to be clear on one point, mm-hmm. You're suggesting the bill would simply make what is now true for single-family housing true for multifamily housing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly correct.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gilley?
Mr. Chair, forgive me if you've explained this to me. You wouldn't ever interpret my question as hostile.
Okay. Of course not.
But why? Just tell me, give me a little background why we're hearing these four bills and how they connect to our committee or what the plan was. I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
Well, I think, Representative Gilliam, that there is an easy case to make for housing and affordable housing being part of economic development. So if we're looking at the various committees that exist in the House, ours is a good one for this kind of a discussion, in my opinion.
Fair enough.
Thanks. No problem. Are there other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. And maybe, I just need a little primer on how this Housing and Community Services Department works. And if everybody else on the committee is all familiar, then maybe you can meet me in my office. But it seems like, okay, I'm reading this. The Housing and Community Services Department is established. The governor appoints a director. And then we have the State Housing Council. Is that mentioned right here, just kind of out of the blue, and then it advises to kind of work together, and then somewhere along the line comes in the community action directors, and then how many programs are there here? Seems like a big, just right on the two paragraphs, there's three entities mentioned. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I'll see if I can answer your questions to help provide a little bit more orientation to Oregon Housing Community Services. We are a very broad agency. I always like to say we are a continuum of programs, that we have a variety of anti-poverty programs as well as a variety of housing programs. And you mentioned the Community Action Directors of Oregon. Through our anti-poverty programs, which is the community resources element, we provide dollars through all of those community action agency networks. And there's oversight provided by the Community Action Directors or Community Action Partnerships of Oregon. So that's one body as it relates to the anti-poverty programs. What we're talking about specifically here today is the housing programs, and we have the State Housing Council that is appointed by the governor, and they provide the oversight, the policymaking, the approvals for all the loans and grants that go through that those particular programs. So those are essentially the two advisory oversight councils for the department for each of their program areas.
Okay, so I'm not missing any, right? Okay, that's no. What I want to make sure, there wasn't some other tucked away somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, Rep. Snatcher, I should say there is one other advisory council that we're going to talk about here shortly, and that's related to one specific program that was started in 1999, but I can speak specifically to that when we come to it.
Questions? No other questions? Okay.
I think you're the only person who has signed up, but we should give anyone else the opportunity who wants to be heard on 2256. Is there anybody else who'd like to testify? Seeing none, we can go ahead and close the public hearing on 2256 and open public hearing on 2257. So if you could help us get started, Robert, please.
House Bill 2257 allows the Housing and Community Services Department to make loans or grants for the purpose of preserving affordable housing from the Community Development Incentive Project Fund without review or recommendation by the Community Development Incentive Advisory Board.
Mr. Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And now to Representative Thatcher's question. Well, first of all, let me again say that we are here today request that OHCS and the State Housing are asking to have the Department and Housing Council as the review approval authority for all community incentive fund programs related to preservation of affordable housing projects. So let me just give you a little background. In 1999, there was created a community incentive fund, and this program was funded with lottery-backed bond dollars by the legislature, and it had essentially three purposes. One was revitalizing downtowns, centers of community activity, promoting affordable housing near jobs and transportation, and third, rebuilding rural and distress economies. Those were the broad areas of the Community Incentive Fund. Also assigned in 1999 was a Community Incentive Fund Advisory Board, which was created to review applications and make recommendations for the approval to the director. So let me be clear that the director was the one approving the loans, but the advisory committee was providing counsel on these various applications that come through. So between 1999 and 2005, the Community Incentive Fund provided $17.7 million in funding for 108 projects across the state. And again, there was authority to do $25 million of lottery-backed bonds. They ended up doing $20 million over that time period. In 2005, the legislature redirected the use of the Community Incentive Fund. So there was a balance of money left at that point. There was this need around the preservation of affordable housing, which we've spoken a lot to the legislature about, where we're trying to preserve all these federally expiring housing projects. The legislature believed that, and was confirmed by council, that the Community Incentive Fund could be used for these purposes. So they redirected the department to use that balance specifically for that purpose. So then when we moved into 07-09 and actually implementing this, we were basically doing awards with the Community Incentive Fund for preservation, which included other awards, grants, tax credits that were approved by the State Housing Council. So we had to take the entire package, go to the State Housing Council, get approval, then pull out another portion, which was the Community Incentive Fund, and go to the advisory board so they can provide advice to go to the director, and then ultimately get approval for housing projects. I think you can see that that was a relatively complicated process. On top of that, the Community Incentive Fund, and their wisdom said, you know, why are we here? What are we doing? The Housing Council is already looking at these loans and grants. Why do we need to be a part of the process? So what we are asking for from you in House Bill 2257 is to provide some clarification that if the legislature deems that we continue to do and continue to use the Community Incentive Fund for the preservation of affordable housing, that those particular projects be exempt from going through the Community Incentive Fund Advisory Board and have the director's ability to approve these in the package with all the other funding processes. Ultimately, bottom line, this is an efficiency. It creates a lot of time and a lot of hassle for a lot of different people, and we would request that you approve House Bill 2257, and Mr. Chairman, I should also mention there is no fiscal impact related to this.
Good. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question. I'm curious. Would eligibility, back up. I understand one of the primary reasons here, efficiency in order to continue to preserve expiring federal programs. But would there be a place here for eligibility for mobile and manufactured housing, specifically for associations that are forming to buy their parks? Would they have an opportunity at a fund like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, absolutely. When we looked at the law 2 years ago with Legislative Fiscal Office and our Budget Committee, it was determined that that particular Community Incentive Fund is very broad. Now, it was directed in our budget hearings that it be used specifically for the preservation of the Section 8 housing that we were targeting. But to answer your question, yes, it could be broad enough to help in the manufactured parks preservation as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Thatcher?
Thank you. How much money are we talking about? Where does it come from? Who gets it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, again, initially the funding was $20 million of lottery-backed bonds. Last session, the legislature, there was about $2.3 million that was left in the Community Incentive Fund that hadn't been used for the original purposes, so we used all that money. But what we have now is money that is trickling back through loans that were created in the Community Incentive Fund. Right now, I would say approximately $250,000 is there, but there will be some loans that are coming back in the next binding that could be helpful for us in our preservation efforts.
And if I'm remembering correctly from our earlier conversation, it's a declining balance over time. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Getting less, it's, unfortunately.
I guess I didn't hear who. I heard that manufactured parks might be able to access. Who normally accesses these funds? Is it local governments? Who I guess isn't clear.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, prior to 2005, when before the legislature accessed them, there was a variety of local, there was counties, there was cities, not-for-profit organizations that accessed them for the Community Incentive Fund purposes. When we changed the, redirected the funds in 2005, primarily users are, they're affordable housing developers, both not-for-profit and for-profit developers that help us in carrying out our mission around affordable housing.
Other questions? Very good. Once again, ask if there's anyone in the audience who's interested in testifying on 2257. Mr. Krieger's the only one who's signed up. Seeing no other interest, we'll close the public hearing on 2257 and open a public hearing on 2258. Barbara.
House Bill 2258 changes the definition of lower-income household for purposes of statutes relating to individual development accounts administered by Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Mr. Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your chair, I'd like to invite Cynthia Winters up to the table. I believe she's signed up as well, and she is from Neighborhood Partnership Fund and helps us in the administration of the Individual Development Account Program.
That'd be fine. Thank you. Welcome.
So, Mr. Chairman, with House Bill 2258, we are essentially requesting to change the eligible income levels for the IDA program, the Individual Development Account program, to the greater of 80% area median income or 200% of federal poverty level. So let me first just give you a little bit of background. I'm sure Santhi will add in some things as well as it relates to the program, just to give you a little understanding of how this works. Currently, the way with IDAs, credits are sold, generating a variety of proceeds to provide to low-income Oregonians for a match to savings that will be then used for education, down payment assistance for home ownership, or small business development. So again, we have the authority by law to issue or to sell tax credits. The proceeds that are generated from those tax credits are then used to match savings by eligible recipients to use for those purposes, again, of education, down payment assistance, and small business development. Currently, the way the law reads is it says that the program serves individuals at 80% of area median income. What we determined in this last year, that in certain parts of the state, particularly in rural parts of the state, where there are larger families, that the program at 80% AMI is actually missing a whole level of individuals that would qualify for the program that are actually at 200% or less than 200% federal poverty level. So there's sort of this, there's the 80% AMI established, and there's the 200% federal poverty level that is actually higher, so there's a whole level of very low-income people that can't access the program. And again, I want to be really clear that the areas that we see that the most is in the rural parts of the state where there are very large families, typically three or four families. So what we're asking to more effectively address those families and needs is to change the statute so that it is the greater of either the 80% area median income or the 200% federal poverty level. Now, Mr. Chairman, as we've discussed, there was a small word in there that didn't seem to fit very well within the bill itself as it relates to the federal poverty rate, and that, is on page 2 of the bill, line 2, where it says 200% of the area poverty guidelines. The word area was not appropriate to have in there, so we are recommending that there be an amendment to strike the word area after consulting with council that it would be more appropriate to say 200% of the poverty guidelines as determined by the department. So, again, in summary, Mr. Chairman, we are requesting to make that change for income eligibility, and once again, we see no fiscal impact with this bill. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer questions, or Cynthia can provide you a little bit more information on the IDA program.
And just as a note of explanation, the reason we discovered that word being unnecessary is that the poverty guidelines are a national calculation, so there would be no need to specify an area. Are there questions, Mr. Krager? Perhaps we can hear from Ms. Winter first. Would that be all right, Representative?
Sure, no, sure.
Okay, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My name is Cynthia Winter. I'm a program director at the Neighborhood Partnership Fund, and today I'm here representing the Oregon IDEA Initiative, as Rick had mentioned. I understand what we're asking of you today is a pretty small technical change, but I thought it would be a nice opportunity to share with you some of the impact that this program has actually having on members of all of our communities. IDEAs are a matched savings program. They help low-income individuals learn savings habits and build financial stability. They are funded by the Oregon IDEA tax credit, as Rick had just mentioned, and there are actually 5 allowable assets that participants can save for. They include purchasing a first-time home, going back and getting an education, expanding or starting a small business. They also are allowable for improvements of a primary dwelling, as well as assistive technology to help folks get back into the workforce. To participate, participants need to qualify by income level, as we're talking about today. They also need to have the ability to make a monthly deposit into a savings account. Sometimes that's as little as $50 a month, but they need to be able to do it on a very consistent basis. They also need to be willing to attend some pretty rigorous financial education courses and asset-specific education. And then once they have done all of that and they meet their savings goal, then every dollar that they saved is matched typically 3-to-1 to purchase that asset. These IDAs are a tool that help families build assets and life skills that keep them really from falling into expensive government safety nets. They provide stability and a foundation for the future, and they really, what happens in this program is that individuals learn very disciplined savings habits, and that's something that they can carry with them wherever they go over any period of time. They complete, as I said, very complex financial education classes, as well as asset-specific training, like if they're saving for a home, they're they take courses like the ABCs of home buying and learn how to maintain that home over time. Small business education, they're learning how to do a business plan, do a feasibility study. We had a participant who wanted to start a printing business in his community, and once he went out and started his feasibility study, he realized there was a print shop practically on every corner that he'd never been to before, and that what the community was really missing was somebody to do high-level art reproduction. And so he saved to purchase a printing press. He's now doing, you know, filled that niche, and his business is doing quite well. About a year ago, we hired Portland State University to do an evaluation of graduates of the program. And we're starting to see some significant behavioral changes from folks that have graduated from this program. Things such as decreased debt, they're increasing their income, and they're saving, they're developing or starting long-term savings plans for things like an IRA, which... it's pretty cool. We've currently got 800 participants active in the program. We actually have a wait list this year for people wanting to get in. And to date, we've had 700 graduates from the program. And I thought if we've got one more second, I'll just share with you one story of a graduate. There's others on the sheet that I handed you. But this Diego... Irwin down in Corvallis has a restaurant down there, and he started at the their Saturday market. He then expanded to the Wednesday farmers market in the area, and a lot of people kept asking him to open up a restaurant. He saved to purchase some additional equipment with his IDA to allow him to do that, and his restaurant is now up and running, and he's employing 8 members of his community. So this is a program that we're really seeing people contributing back into their communities once they get this education. So that's all I have. Thank you for supporting the program. Thank you for supporting this change to allow more folks to participate, and I look forward to keeping you involved in more success stories.
I'd be happy to hear them. Thank you very much. Representative Bence, you had a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, it's 2 questions. The first is, how many more folks might be attracted to the program as a result of reducing the standard, according to this chart, it appears, for example, looks like it's going down by about 30%. In other words, 80% of MFI, $32,950, the new standard will be $20,000, looks like it's down about $10,000, $12,000. How many more people, it looks like it's pretty standard across the board, how many more people might be anticipate?
I don't know that we actually have a specific number. What our partners in throughout the state have told us is that occasionally, and it's been a small number, but occasionally they've bumped into families that actually would qualify, but because of this technicality are not able to. So I think we're talking about a small number of participants. Population-wise, I don't know what we would be.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Bence, I would just add to that, when you look at the different levels, typically where we see that difference, where it would really start to change, is when you get into those very larger families. So usually 4 people and more is where it starts to change. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Bence, I'd be happy to share with you, we have sort of a breakdown here of every county in the state and where we would see the different changes between what is 80% area median income and low. And actually, I think, I'm sorry, it looks like you have that up there, so I apologize.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason I ask, of course, is that it looks as though from the testimony here, Deputy Director Krieger, that the funding mechanism is a tax credit. And I was just curious, first of all, how much of that tax credit is currently being used for each biennium, and how much more we might anticipate needing as a result of this increased program.
That's a question I was going to ask too. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bence, excellent question, and one that Cynthia and I were just talking to it prior to coming up to testify. Currently, and just a little bit of background, in the individual development account right now in law doesn't have a specific cap that is in some cases, like the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, there's actually a cap on how much you can do. What the department has been doing with the legislature over the last several years is kind of a ramp up of the individual development account, and many of you have participated in understanding that particular ramp up schedule. Right now, we have in calendar year 2008, our total target was $8 million is what we're going to do. In the next 3 years, our target was going to be $10 million. And again, this is what we had reported to the legislature in previous sessions. Last year was very successful, and actually, I probably should just let Cynthia respond in terms of the actual amounts of credits, but we are seeing a slowdown in the use of those tax credits just because there's not the money to be able to contribute. But maybe I should let Cynthia respond in terms of the actual amounts.
And a quick question just as you do that. Is that also the what is functionally the limitation when you mention the waiting list of people who want to participate?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So in 2007, the cap for the credits was $6 million. We reached that cap that year, and we dispersed all of those funds out the following January, or January of 2008. 2008, our maximum cap was $8 million. We did not meet that. We generated about $4.5 million, and the biggest difference was that we saw was the difference in the stock market. So our stock contributions were down considerably.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vince, just to add to that, and was reminded that in terms of the credits, so when Cynthia speaks to $6 million, total credits, that's the actual dollars. The credit piece on that is $8 million. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so it's basically for every credit, it's
75%, so 75 cents for every dollar.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just got a couple of questions around the medium household income for the area, and I'm assuming, and it's determined by, you know, the Housing and Community Services Department, I'm assuming from this chart that they're using counties as the area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holy, that is correct.
And do you have a date on for this? Is what... what year did these income levels come from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, I don't have an exact date, but I know that these are the most current numbers that we get from Housing and Urban Development.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
And thank you. And that leads to my next question is there a requirement to use the data from the Housing and Urban Development as opposed to the State Employment Department's figures?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, currently there's nothing specific in law that would, and we have traditionally used that the Housing and Urban Development numbers just because that has been a standard for a lot of the federal programs that are used, but there's nothing in law that would prevent us from using that employment division, I don't believe. And if Janet Berg behind me, I'm not sure she knows specifically on
page,
that.
Page 2, it also says the Department of Health and Human Services.
You have to consider, right?
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, as I said, that with on the bill on page 30 and 31, that in making the determination, the department shall consider to any data on area household income published by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. So,
Health and Human Services?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Health and Human Services?
It would have to be through, no, you wouldn't be able to include. Use that. It would be 80% of the median income for the area as determined by the department. In making the determination that the department shall give consideration to any data published by it would have to be specific to HUD.
Okay. And then follow up, Mr. Chair?
Maybe I can help clarify your confusion. You're looking on page 2 at
yes,
the poverty guidelines,
okay,
which are
thank
from
you.
Health and Human
right.
Services.
Right.
And
thank you.
I'm speaking of household income.
Got it. Thank you.
But I guess my question was, it's Oregon statute that makes us reference the HUD household income as opposed to using the Employment Department. The reason I just bring this question up is I'm just curious what the comparison between the two is. Are there differences between the Employment Department's version of what the household area median household income for an area is as opposed to HUD, and how often are those reviewed by HUD as opposed to being reviewed by Oregon State Employment Department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hovey, I'll be honest, I don't have the answer for you on that question, but I'd be more than happy to research that and give you some information that shows you the differences in that process for review.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, the only reason I bring that up is I'm just wondering how responsive these numbers are to this program, and it seems like we might want to consider whichever one is the most responsive to actually addressing the current status of that income level.
It's a good point, Representative Holley, and I assume that you're always using the most up-to-date data, and we'd want to look at how...
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. The data that we have is the most up-to-date HUD data that we have at this point.
Okay. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good question. Sure. I just was curious, as following up on my comment on the tax credits, if indeed we're going, if there's a possibility of using more, isn't that a revenue impact, and thus shouldn't this be referred out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, certainly to the extent that we exceed, we were to exceed our cap, then we see it as a revenue impact. However, we've got an agreement that we're going to do the $10 million each year, and so we don't see it as anything additional. By changing this law, we wouldn't do anything additional than what we agreed to.
And we do have, I'll note, a revenue impact statement that notes it as minimal, in other words, less than $50,000 per biennium.
Follow up,
please.
It happened that I was discussing the method of marketing these tax credits in a subcommittee of revenue, and I just wonder how your organization markets those credits. Do you do it on your own, or are you working with another department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, actually, we do work with another department to my right. This is the Neighborhood Partnership Fund. They provide the services for us in terms of marketing the tax credit, but in addition, providing us with some administrative oversight as it relates to the program. And maybe Cynthia could speak a little bit to the marketing process.
Certainly. What specifically was your question?
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is whether we as a state are getting the full best possible impact for the tax credit dollar. And, of course, the marketing mechanism will determine how many dollars actually go to the purpose for which the credit was issued and how many don't, because the spread, of course, goes to the person buying the credit. And so I'm just curious if you think that there is an opportunity through using a better market mechanism for these tax credits to benefit everybody except the person buying them. There's a spread, and the spread goes to the person that buys them. So that's my question.
So just to clarify, is your question what percentage of the tax credit is actually going out to the participants, and what percentage is going to what the donor is getting back?
Yeah, my question is this. If Oregon issues a tax credit for $1,
right,
then that tax credit is sold to someone who can use it. And there's a discount. So the exact amount that then goes for the purpose for what it's used is not necessarily the full dollar, because there's a discount. And I'm curious if the market, that spread, that marketing discount, is sometimes set up through private arrangements with the buyer, mm-hmm. and sometimes through a marketing mechanism like a federal tax credit sometimes. They're all different. And I'm just curious if you think that we could put together a device that would get more of the money going where we want it to go.
Okay. The credit is currently set up as a 75% tax credit. So for every dollar that's contributed, 75 cents comes back to the donor as a credit. We take those funds and disperse them out to the program participants. And we're marketing this specifically. Currently, we've been marketing it to tax accountants, advisors, CPAs that have high wealth donors, pretty much is how we're marketing it, or the who we're marketing it to. Statute defines how that credit is then the allowable uses for that credit. So currently 2% of the funds are allowable for marketing the credits, 5% are allowable for administration of the fiduciary organizations to handle the money, 20% goes to case management of the participants, and the remainder, 73%, actually goes to create that pool of match funds. Now, I don't know if I've just answered your question or not.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For today's purposes, that's sufficient.
Okay, thanks.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I sense where you might be going is so if you know you issue a dollar tax credit and you get 75 cents, who's to say you can't issue a dollar credit and get 95 cents? And is that ideally where you're wanting to see if maybe there's a market out there to potentially push a little bit to achieve that? And I think it's something that we would, you know, need to serve.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird. I'm the executive director of the Neighborhood Partnership Fund. So for every dollar that's contributed to Neighborhood Partnership Fund as a charitable contribution, a 75-cent tax credit is issued. So the states, we don't use a discounting mechanism as you might use for a low-income housing tax credit or another kind of mechanism. The state actually gets a dollar's worth of program dollar for every 75 cents of credit.
And we should thank Representative Gilliam for the suggestion to open the curtain. I've been so focused on the content of this nice legislation that I've missed the nice sunny day. Are there further questions? One that I would just ask, there are three of us on this committee who are also on the Revenue Committee, and of course it's something of a requirement instituted by our chair in Revenue that we be fairly explicit about the purpose and expected outcome for policy changes. So would it be fair to look at your testimony, Ms. Winter, the five areas that are eligible for the program as a summary of the purpose and intended outcome for this credit?
Can you please repeat that, Mr. Chair?
Sure. So when a tax credit or a general program of that sort goes forward, we'd like to make sure that we're identifying very explicitly what the intent is so that in subsequent years and subsequent legislatures that are evaluating it can look at what were we trying to accomplish and did this mechanism do that. So I'm asking if the five things that are on your testimony, purchasing a new home, starting or expanding a small business, if that list, all five of them, would constitute a reasonable summary of our intent with this program that would allow us to come back and evaluate it in the future.
Yes.
Terrific. Thank you. No further questions. I'll look. I think you're the only two who signed up, so asking once again if anyone else wants to testify on House Bill 2258. And seeing no takers, close the public hearing on 2258 and open public hearing on 2261.
House Bill 2261 authorizes the Department of Housing and Community Services to grant loans financed with the sale of tax-exempt bonds coupled with Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit Program tax credits to qualified affordable housing developers.
That's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce Mr. Mike Schrader from Oreck, Caron & Sutcliffe. He's a bond counsel for the department and provides a lot of support during transactions, and I was going to have him speak a little bit to the verification of this particular bill and it meeting the intent that we set forward. But to start with, Mr. Chairman, again, thank you. House Bill 2261 is to request to codify in Oregon statutes that the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit can be used in conjunction with loans that were funded by bonds issued by Oregon Housing Community Services. So just a quick background and overview of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. We by law are allowed to issue up to $17 million of tax credits per year for the purpose of Oregon affordable housing for developing housing throughout the state. For every $1 million of tax credit, we get $25 million in very, very low interest rate loans. So essentially, banks are the buyers of our Oregon affordable housing tax credit. They reduce their interest rate on their loans, and that's how they achieve the credit. last session, or I should say in 2007, we started exploring the idea of using Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit in conjunction with tax-exempt debt. So when we go out and issue tax-exempt debt, we're able to achieve very low interest rates, loans, for affordable housing developers. The idea is that if you use those bonds and then, you know, create a loan, can you reduce that interest rate even more? Because typically when you use the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, you're able to bring the loan down by four percentage points. So if in the conventional market today you're getting a 7% interest rate, take that down, you get a 3% interest rate, and those savings are then translated into rent reductions for the residents of the property. So we wanted to then, again, like I said, try to see if we can use that in conjunction with our bonds. If we're able to get 5%, that could potentially turn into a 1% loan, and again, the savings would be passed down to the residents. So we explored that with the Department of Revenue as it relates to the tax credit. We explored that with the Department of Justice, and we got an interpretation that yes, indeed, you could use the OHTC in conjunction with the tax-exempt bond. So what we've been able to do is in this structure using bonds and Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, we've been actually able to finance 786 units through this methodology. The problem is when we do bond transaction, there is a requirement the bond council on behalf of bondholders have to review the structures. They have to know that explicitly you can do this. And because it's not codified in law, it's interpreted by the Department of Justice, they need to get some kind of letter interpretation from the DOJ or the Department of Revenue that verifies that. That's a process that we have to go through. It has some legal costs associated, and most of the time those legal costs are passed on to the affordable housing developer. What we'd like to try to do here today through House Bill 2261 is truly be explicit in law that you can do this, so that bond counsel, when reviewing transaction, have that in law and don't have to go through all of the process associated with getting an opinion. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thought I'd just let Mike speak a little bit to this particular bill and his interpretation.
Thank you, Mr. Trader. Please go ahead, and if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself for the record, that would help.
Thank you, Chairman Reed and members of the committee. My name is Michael Schrader. I'm an attorney with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe in Portland. We serve as bond counsel to Oregon Housing and Community Services Department in connection with its conduit revenue bond program. Just a little bit more technical background. I want to thank Rick for that fine summary in terms of what we're doing here. It is a technical bill. No expansion of the credit. It's simply an application, a clarification to allow an explicit application of the credits in a context they're already being applied to through advice from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice. As Rick indicated, under the conduit revenue bond program, the state, acting through the treasurer and the department, can issue tax-exempt bonds, which are then the proceeds of which are loaned to a project owner for a qualified affordable project. So to carry on with Rick's example, that means that if you'd gotten a conventional loan and hadn't issued tax-exempt bonds, your cost of funds might be, for example, 7%, whereas if you issued tax-exempt bonds, your loan is going to be at, say, 5%. Again, the difference between a taxable and a tax-exempt loan will vary, but there's usually a pretty significant spread in the cost. So for purposes of our example, let's say 7% and 5%. The question is, does your 4% apply to your 4% OAHTC? Does it apply to a 7% rate or a 5% rate? This bill will confirm that it can apply to either the 7% rate or the 5% rate, and we have, in fact, done transactions where we've had permanent long-term borrowing rates on a tax-exempt bond with the Affordable Housing Tax Credit with rates in the 1 to 2%, which is a tremendous way to promote affordable housing in the state by lowering the cost of funds. The technical issue in the current statute is a bond financing a loan for purposes of the statute? The statute uses the term loan, qualified loan, and if you look in the bill itself, in Section 1, there's a new expanded definition of qualified loan that confirms that, in fact, a lender, a financial institution that purchases a bond is treated the same as a financial institution who makes a direct loan. There's no economic difference in terms of it's a loaning of money. It's a contribution of funding to the project. So that's really the core of this bill is to clarify and make explicit that a tax-exempt bond financing qualifies as a loan for purposes of the OAHTC. And as Rick indicated, there has been significant administrative cost and expense associated with actually using the OAHTC in connection with a tax-exempt bond issue. The lenders are, this is important to lenders. Before they reduce that rate 4%, they want to have some absolute certainty that 4% credit is in fact available. And the general guidance from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice gets them partway, but it's been on a project financing specific basis that we've had to go back to the Department of Revenue, get specific advice on the specific terms and details of the transaction for each project that has been financed. And then in addition to that, our firm as bond counsel issuing an opinion that in fact confirms the availability of the credit on that. So this bill will streamline and make the use of the OAHTC, particularly in connection with tax-exempt bonds, much more efficient.
Thank you. And so from a procedural standpoint, what's really happening here is that we're saying, making a more universal declaration in statute so that on each individual transaction, we don't have to go through the process of confirming that, yes, this is acceptable, yes, this is acceptable. Is that about
precisely
right?
Precisely.
Thank you. Representative Holby?
Thank you. I just have a question that may not be relevant at all, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I'm just kind of curious whether the tax credits under the tax credit program are ever sufficient or more in terms of being enough to pay the debt service on the bonds.
The tax credit here is simply a reduction in the interest cost to the borrower. Now, in different, I'll let Rick speak to more of the details of that in terms of the availability of the credit, and I'll be a backup if I'm not being directly responsible. The availability of the credit, essentially threefold. One, affordable housing projects generally, provided that those cost savings are passed through to the borrower. So in that context, the credit doesn't go to project feasibility. The other context is in manufactured housing financings or in preservation projects. In both of those contexts, I believe, certainly in the latter, in the preservation, which was we've been involved in, that 4% credit reduces the cost of funds and therefore enhances the feasibility of the project in terms of how much rent do you have, what's your cost of the project, how much rent do you have to generate to make it cash flow, and so forth. Is that responsive?
Follow-up?
Well, my eyes just sort of glazed over there. No, I mean, I understood your answer, but I'm not sure it was the question I had.
Let's try to give the question then.
I was just trying to get a relationship of how big the tax credit is in relationship to the debt service on the bond. Is there even a connection to the two?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Holy, there isn't a connection. Like Mr. Schrader said, it's essentially a reduction of the cost of funds to get the project to the point that it can create more affordability.
Yeah, that answered my question, was the connection between the two. Thank you.
Thanks. Other questions? Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suppose since you're bond counsel, the proper question for us to ask is if you won't have to write an opinion letter, as you have previously, following the enactment of this legislation.
Following the enactment of this legislation, we will still give the bond counsel opinion. Historically, is required to cover two things when you issue bonds. One is validity. That is, if the state and the department have jumped through the hoops and complied with the statutory requirements within their powers and procedural compliance. So a validity opinion. And then the other part of that opinion is a federal tax exemption opinion. Those are the two key components of any bond counsel opinion. That won't change as a result of this bill. What we've had to do currently is in affordable housing projects where we've got the OAHTC in connection with the tax-exempt bond financing is we've had to give a third opinion, which goes to the availability of the affordable housing tax credit. With the passage of 2261, we will no longer have to give that third opinion.
Thank you. And because of the substantial reduction in risk, now that you don't have to add that portion to your letter, that will save those asking for the letter substantial sums in attorney fees.
Yes, it will lower transaction costs.
Correct.
We appreciate your willingness to support something that might not be in your own best interest in order to help the laudable goals of the department. Other questions? I'll note that this has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue, so they will have a look at it as well. If there aren't anyone else who wants to testify on 2261, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on 2261. Committee, I think we've got a good sense of these bills, and it would be my intent to take them up on Thursday. We'll do our best to have that amendment that we talked about to remove the unnecessary word in 2258, I believe. So we'll look to do those on Thursday. If any other business before the committee, if there's not, Representative Foley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to get an answer to my question on House Bill 2258 about the usage of the HUD area for median income and what the impacts to the program would be if we actually use the state employment data. Because I think, I guess it's a matter of how often do they update this information. Is there a discrepancy between the state data and the HUD data? And maybe there's a reason through federal programs that they use the HUD data. I don't know that, but I'd just like to have an answer to that.
Sure. We can ask the department to help get that information to you, and we can follow up on that before Thursday.
Yeah.
You bet. If there aren't any other items before the committee, we will adjourn a bit early, and see you on Thursday. Thanks.